open officially until 1984, 31 years later. The other problem is that adaptation requires money to be invested now. Many countries just do not have the money, and elsewhere in the world, people do not want to pay more taxes to protect themselves in the future, as most people live for today. This is, of course, despite the fact that all of the adaptations discussed will, in the long term, save money for the local area, the country, and the world. As a global society, we still have a very short-term view, usually measured in a few years between successive governments. Hence, the solutions to global warming will have to combine adaptations with the mitigation strategies discussed later. If global carbon trading is adopted in the post-2012 agreement, then this would provide a flow of money to developing countries, which could be used to build in climate change adaptation. The one thing that every single government can do now is to set up a climate change impact assessment. For example, in the UK, there is the UK Climate Impact Programme, which in January 2009 launched new products, based on the latest IPCC 2007 reports, showing the possible effects of climate change on the UK over the next 100 years. These products are aimed at the UK national and local government, industry, business, the media, and the general public. If every government set up one of these programs, then at least their citizens would have the information to make informed choices about how their countries should be adapting to climate change. Mitigation. The idea of cutting global carbon emissions in half in the next 30 years and by up to 80% by the end of the century may sound like fantasy. However, already the United Kingdom and California have made legally binding commitments to reduce carbon emissions by 60% by 2050. Steve Pakala and Robert Sokolow, researchers at Princeton University, published a very influential paper in the journal Science, which makes this challenge seem more achievable. They took the business-as-usual emissions scenario and the desired 450 ppm scenario and described the difference between the two as a number of wedges. So, on this view, instead of seeing one huge insurmountable problem, really what we are faced with are lots of medium-sized changes which add up to the big change. They also provided several examples for the wedges, each of them approximately saving 1 gigaton of carbon every year. For example, one wedge would be doubling the efficiency of 2 billion cars from 30 mpg to 60 mpg, which actually is a very achievable aim, as cars have already been built that can easily do 100 mpg. Though Steve Pakala and Robert Sokolow provide examples of what we can do to achieve the required cuts in greenhouse gases, each country will have different strengths and weaknesses and can apply the most suitable wedges for them. One of the first measures that all countries, industries, and individuals can take is to be more energy efficient. At the moment, the energy use in an average home in the USA is twice that of the average for California, and California's domestic energy use is twice that of Denmark. So already, within the developed world, there are huge savings to be made just by improving energy efficiency. It remains a puzzle why industry and business do not improve their energy use, as this can significantly cut running costs. However, this may be in part capitalists' obsession with turnover and profit. Efficiency gains, however, will ultimately be taken over by increased use. For example, if we did double the efficiency of 2 billion cars, this gain would be wiped out once another 2 billion cars were brought into the world. So one of the most important areas is the production of clean or carbon-free energy, discussed now. Alternative, renewable, or clean energy. We must remember that fossil fuels were an amazing invention, and they have allowed the world to develop at a faster rate than at any time in history. The high standard of living in the developed world is based on cheap and relatively safe fossil fuels, so it is rather naive to then complain about them or depict them as evil. However, what we do need to do is to replace our reliance on them with carbon-free or so-called renewable or alternative energy sources. This is essential, as the power needs of humanity will continue to expand due to the rapid development of China, India, and other countries. As we have commented, China is opening a new coal-fired power station every 4 days. This energy expansion is not limited to the developing world. In the UK, there will need to be at least another 20 petawatts of power generated by 2020. The global demand for fossil fuels is so strong that while writing this book, oil prices peaked at $149 a barrel in July 2008 and are still at $110 a barrel in September 2008 and seem set to continue to be very high for the next few years. There is also concern that we have reached peak oil and that the world is now running out of oil. This does, however, provide two other reasons why countries should adopt a less intensive carbon energy sector. First, because the era of power from gas and oil will soon be over, due to a combination of huge global demands and dwindling global reserves. Second, countries have in the 21st century become very aware of energy security. Most developed countries' economies are heavily reliant on the import of fossil fuels, making them very vulnerable to international blackmail. What follows is a brief discussion of the main alternative energy sources. Straight away, you can see how different portfolios fit different countries. For example, the UK has the best wind resource in the whole of Europe, while Saudi Arabia has excellent conditions for solar power. Low-carbon energy sources. Biomass energy fuels. Globally, biomass energy makes up 10% of the world's energy supply. Unfortunately, this is mainly through simple wood fires in the developing world. 2.4 billion people use biomass fuels to cook, and this leads to significant health problems due to indoor pollution. So there is an urgent need to provide clean electricity to help human development. Biofuels, on the other hand, will be essential in the fight to reduce global carbon emissions, as they are an intermediate solution. At the moment, the global economy is based on liquid fossil fuels mainly for the transport sector. We can, in the short term, use fuels derived from plants as a carbon-neutral way of powering cars, ships, and airplanes. There are problems, as the production of biofuels will compete with food crops. Geothermal. Below our feet, deep within the earth, is hot, molten rock. In some locations, for example in Iceland and Kenya, this hot rock comes very close to the earth's surface and can be used to heat water to make steam. This is an excellent carbon-free source of energy, because the part of the electricity you generate from the steam, you use to pump the water down to the hot rocks. Unfortunately, it is limited by geography. There is, however, another way the warmth of the earth can be used. All new buildings can have a borehole below them with ground-sourced heat pumps. Cold water is then pumped down into these boreholes, and the ground warms the water up, cutting the cost of providing hot water to the building. Hydroenergy. Hydroelectric power is globally an important source of energy. In 2004, it supplied 5% of the world's energy. The majority of the electricity comes from large dam projects. These projects can present major ethical problems, as large areas of land must be flooded above the dam, causing mass relocation of people and destruction of the local environment. A dam also slows water from flowing down a river and prevents nutrient-rich silt from being deposited lower down. If the river crosses national boundaries, there are potential issues over the rights to water and silt. For example, one of the reasons why Bangladesh is sinking is the lack of silts due to dams on the major rivers in India. There is also a debate about how much greenhouse gas hydroelectric plants save, because even though the production of electricity does not cause any carbon emissions, the rotting vegetation in the area flooded behind the dam does give off significant amounts of methane. Nuclear fission. Energy is generated when you split heavy atoms, such as uranium, and this is nuclear fission. It has a very low direct carbon signature, but a significant amount of carbon is generated both mining the uranium and decommissioning the power station. At the moment, 5% of global energy is generated by nuclear power. The new generation of nuclear power stations are extremely efficient, producing nearly 90% of the theoretical possible energy production. Two main disadvantages of nuclear power are the generation of high-level radioactive waste and safety. Though improvements in efficiency reduce waste, and the new generations of nuclear reactors have state-of-the-art safety precautions built in. There is also the problem that nuclear power in the wrong hands can lead to dangerous nuclear weapons. The advantages of nuclear power, however, are that it is reliable and can react to changing consumer demand throughout the day, and it is technology that is ready to go and already thoroughly tested. Nuclear fusion. Nuclear fusion is the generation of energy when two smaller atoms are fused together. This is what happens in our sun and every other star. The idea is that the heavy form of hydrogen, which can be found in seawater, and lithium can be combined, and the only waste product is the non-radioactive gas helium. Using a bath full of water and the lithium from a single laptop battery could provide the energy needs for a person for 7 years. The problem, of course, is persuading those two atoms to join together. The sun does it by subjecting the atoms to incredibly high temperatures and pressures. Some advances have been made at the Joint European Torus, JET, project in the UK, which has produced 16 megawatts of fusion power. The problem is, the amount of energy required to generate the huge temperatures in the first place, and the difficulty of scaling it up to a power plant size. Solar heating. The sun produces a huge amount of heat. The trick is to capture this heat and to use it. On a small scale, houses and other buildings in sunny countries can have solar heating panels on the roofs which heat up water, so people can have carbon-free hot showers and baths. On a large scale, parabolic mirrors are used to focus the solar energy to generate hot liquid, water or oil, to drive turbines to create electricity. The best places to situate solar heat plants are in low-latitude deserts, which have very few cloudy days per year. Solar heat plants have been built in California since the 1980s and are now being built in many other countries. Solar photovoltaic, solar panels. The individual rays of the sun hit the solar panel and dislodge electrons inside it, creating an electrical current. The main advantage of solar panels is that you can place them where the energy is needed and avoid all the complicated infrastructure normally required to move electricity around. The scale of projects involving solar panels varies massively, from the San Francisco Moscone Conference Center, which generates 675,000 watts, to Kenya, which has the largest penetration of solar panels of any market, but comprising single 18-watt units. At the moment, the best solar panel is about 17% efficient, which is great compared with photosynthesis, which is about 1%, but is a long way off being competitive with other energy sources. Another drawback of current solar panels is that they require silicon, which keeps the cost high. What is needed is a technological breakthrough that would allow solar panels to be made from cheap plastic or some other inexpensive and adaptable material. Wave. Wave power could be an important source of energy in the future. The concept is simple. To convert the continuous movement of the ocean in the form of waves into electricity. However, this is easier said than done, and experts in the field suggest that wave power is now where solar panel technology was about 20 years ago. Lots of catching up required. There are also questions about how much environmental damage may be caused to coastal marine habitats by interrupting or deflecting waves. Wind. Wind turbines are an efficient means of generating electricity, if they are big enough. The energy generated directly corresponds to the size of the turbine. So the small wind turbines that conscientious people have been putting on the roofs of their houses are almost useless. What you really want are turbines about the size of the Statue of Liberty for maximum effectiveness. It is also more efficient to build wind farms out at sea. More wind, but of course also more costly. The problems with wind turbines are twofold. First, they do not supply a constant source of electricity. If the wind does not blow, then there is no electricity. Second, people do not like them, as they think they are ugly, noisy, and worry about the effects on local natural habitats. All these problems are easy to overcome by situating wind farms in remote locations and out at sea and away from areas of special scientific or natural interest. One study suggests that wind, in principle, could generate over 125,000 terawatt hours, which is 5 times the current global electricity requirement. Carbon capture and storage. Removal of carbon dioxide during industrial processes is tricky and costly, because not only does the CO2 need to be removed, but it must be stored somewhere as well. Removal and storage costs could be somewhere between $10 and $50 per ton CO2. This would cause a 15% to 100% increase in power production costs. However, recovered CO2 does not all need to be stored. Some may be utilized in enhanced oil recovery, the food industry, chemical manufacturing, producing soda ash, urea, and methanol, and the metal processing industries. CO2 can also be applied to the production of construction material, solvents, cleaning compounds, and packaging, and in wastewater treatment. But in reality, most of the carbon dioxide captured from industrial processes would have to be stored. It has been estimated that, theoretically, 2/3 of the CO2 formed from the combustion of the world's total oil and gas reserves could be stored in the corresponding reservoirs. Other estimates indicate storage of 90 to 400 gigatons in natural gas fields alone, and another 90 gigatons in aquifers. Oceans could also be used to dispose of the carbon dioxide. Suggestions have included storage by hydrate dumping. If you mix carbon dioxide and water at high pressure and low temperatures, it creates a solid, or hydrate, which is heavier than the surrounding water and thus drops to the bottom. This hydrate is very similar to the methane hydrates discussed in Chapter 6. Another more recent suggestion is to inject the carbon dioxide 0.5 mile deep into shattered volcanic rocks in between giant lava flows. The carbon dioxide will react with the water percolating through the rocks. The acidified water will dissolve metals in the rocks, mainly calcium and aluminum. Once it forms calcium bicarbonate with the calcium, it can no longer bubble out and escape. Though if it does escape into the ocean, then bicarbonate is relatively harmless. The major problem with all of these methods of storage is safety. Carbon dioxide is a very dangerous gas because it is heavier than air and can cause suffocation. An important example of this occurred in 1986 when a tremendous explosion of CO2 from Lake Neos in the west of Cameroon killed more than 1,700 people and livestock up to 25 kilometers away. Though similar disasters had previously occurred, never had so many people and animals been asphyxiated on such a scale in a single brief event. What scientists now believe happened was that dissolved CO2 from the nearby volcano seeped from springs beneath the lake and was trapped in deep water by the weight of water above. In 1986, there was an avalanche, which mixed up the lake waters, resulting in an explosive overturn of the whole lake, and all the trapped carbon dioxide was released in one go, proving that the storage of carbon dioxide is very difficult and potentially lethal. With ocean storage, there is the added complication that the ocean circulates. So whatever carbon dioxide you dump, some of it will eventually return. Moreover, scientists are very uncertain about the environmental effects on the ocean ecosystems. However, at this very moment, huge amounts of carbon dioxide are being pumped around the USA to allow enhanced recovery of oil. There are no reports of any major incidents, and engineers working on these pipelines feel that they are much safer than the gas and oil pipelines which run across most major cities. More globally, however, we currently have no reliable estimates of the amount of CO2 that could be safely stored. Transport. I have included a short section on transport here, as this is one of the major human contributions to global warming. At the moment, transport accounts for 13% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. In the UK, the carbon emissions from energy production, business, and residential sectors are all going down despite strong annual growth in the UK economy, 2.5% per year. But even the UK government admits that transport emissions, mainly from cars, are growing at a formidable rate. A report in 2007 by the UCL Environment Institute suggested that over the next 20 years, this growth in car use could wipe out all the cuts in carbon emissions made by the UK since 1990. If we extrapolate this to the rest of the world, we have everyone in the developing world aspiring to have the same standard of living as the West, and that includes at least one car per household and regular holidays by aeroplane. In respect to cars, there are two possible solutions: biofuels and electricity. Biofuels have been discussed earlier and mean that the current infrastructure of providing liquid fuel to cars could be maintained. But as we have seen, biofuels must be carefully produced, as they can compete for land use with food production, can result in tropical deforestation, and can still be net emitters of carbon due to transport and production costs. Ultimately, electric cars are the future, because it can be guaranteed that the electricity produced is carbon neutral. At the moment, we already have hybrid cars which combine a petrol engine with a battery system. This can improve engine efficiency and cut carbon emissions by an average of 50%. It would be an important step forward if all new cars produced had to have this type of system. The next step would be improvement in battery life and the building of infrastructure to allow cars to charge up. Just as you charge up your mobile phone at home, you would do the same for your car. Airplanes have become an easy target for climate change campaigners. International flights are not covered by the Kyoto Protocol, nor any other international treaty. But at the moment, just 1.6% of global emissions come from aviation. Research is being carried out to see whether a biofuel can be produced that is light enough and powerful enough to replace the traditional air fuel, kerosene, though this seems a long way off at the time of writing. Hydrogen is not a solution because its byproduct is water. This is fine on the ground, but high up in the air, it produces cirrus clouds, which contribute to warming the planet. Since at present there is no real fuel solution for aviation, the airlines are keen to be involved in carbon trading. This way, the airlines can offset their carbon emissions by ensuring an equivalent amount was saved elsewhere. Carbon trading. As discussed in Chapter 7, one of the most important tools in Europe to ensure that carbon emissions are lowered is carbon trading. If alternative energy and carbon capture and storage are to be economically viable, then global carbon trading is essential. When Madame Fu Ying, Chinese ambassador to the UK, visited University College London, she asked me when would it be cost-effective for China to fit carbon capture to their coal-fired power stations. I answered honestly, never, as the electricity produced will always be more expensive if you have to capture and store the carbon emitted, unless you can then trade the carbon saved on an international stock market to make a profit. The European trading scheme and EU laws are already making renewable sources of energy more competitive. So we must remember that if we really want to switch the global economy away from carbon and on to alternative energy sources and carbon capture and storage, we need a fiscal method to drive the markets. So far, the only approach that seems to have worked within countries and trading blocs is the cap and trade system based on carbon. Offsetting. One of the most controversial aspects of carbon trading is offsetting. At the moment, this occurs through two systems: the UN Clean Development Mechanism, CDM, and the voluntary markets. The CDM has been described in Chapter 7. And basically, UN-certified programs in developing countries can be funded which make significant greenhouse gas savings. These can include preventing methane release from an abandoned mine, increasing energy efficiency, or solar power or wind power generation. The CDM credits can be bought by countries or through the voluntary market. For example, every time you fly, you can buy, through a number of companies, carbon offsets equivalent to the carbon emitted on your flight. In the West, a new branding of carbon-neutral products has arisen. This seems to encompass anything from television companies, such as BSkyB, to paper manufacture, such as the Arja Wiggins Conqueror brand. Offsetting is controversial, as it is argued that many of these cuts would have been made anyway. And also, it means that companies and people may not be motivated to change their actual behaviors. On a practical level, however, it does offer a way that individuals, companies, and countries can make a difference. It also provides a means of dealing with unavoidable carbon emissions, such as from aviation. What does need to happen is for there to be clear global rules on what is and is not an acceptable carbon offset. There also needs to be a clear verification service to ensure that the carbon saved is really saved. Geoengineering or technofixes. Geoengineering, also referred to as technofixes or geohacking, always sounds like a Hollywood B-movie. This is because it looks at changing the environment on the planetary scale. Suggestions range from removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, either by building artificial trees or by stimulating the oceans to take up more carbon. Other scientists have suggested erecting massive mirrors in space or injecting aerosols into the atmosphere to reduce the amount of sunlight falling on Earth, balancing the heating from global warming. The fundamental problem with all of these approaches is that scientists have no idea what effects they would have. At the moment, scientists are performing one of the largest geoengineering experiments ever undertaken by injecting huge amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. As this book has shown, we understand that climate change will occur due to this action, but exactly how much and where, we do not know. This is equally true of these techno fixes. We have no idea if they would work or what unaccounted-for side effects they might have. In many ways, global warming for the Earth can be seen in the same way as illness and the human body. It is always preferable to prevent an illness than to try and cure one. And we all know the potential side effects of drugs or chemo or radiation therapy. One of the famous techno-fixes was suggested by the late Professor John Martin. He suggested that many of the world's oceans are underproducing. This is because of the lack of vital nutrients, the most important of which is iron, which allows plants to grow in the surface waters. Marine plants need minute quantities of iron, and without it, they cannot grow. In most oceans, enough iron-rich dust gets blown in from the land, but it seems that large areas of the Pacific and Southern Ocean do not receive much dust and thus are barren of iron. So it has been suggested that we could fertilize the ocean with iron to stimulate marine productivity. The extra photosynthesis would convert more surface water carbon dioxide into organic matter. When the organisms die, the organic matter drops to the bottom of the ocean, taking with it and storing the extra carbon. The reduced surface water carbon dioxide is replenished by carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So, in short, fertilizing the world's oceans could help to remove atmospheric carbon dioxide and store it in deep sea sediments. Experiments at sea have shown that the amount of iron required is huge. Also, as soon as you stop adding the extra iron, most of this stored carbon dioxide is released, as very little organic matter is allowed to escape out of the photic zone. Another possible solution, advocated in Kunzig and Brecker's book Fixing Climate, is the production of artificial trees. Klaus Lackner, a theoretical physicist, and Alan Wright, an engineer, supported by Wally Brecker, a climatologist, have designed CO2-binding plastic, which can scrub carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. The CO2 is then released from the plastic and taken away for storage. The problem here is one of scale. Tens of millions of these giant artificial trees would be required just to deal with U.S. carbon emissions. We are also left with the problem of how to transport and sequester the carbon safely. Lastly, on the idea of mirrors to deflect the sunlight, the most sophisticated of these suggestions is from Roger Angel, director of the Center for Astronomical Adaptive Optics at the University of Arizona, who suggests a mesh of tiny reflectors to bend some of the light away from the Earth. He himself admits this would be expensive, requiring 16 trillion Gossamer Light spacecraft, costing at least $1 trillion and taking 30 years to launch. But even then, it would not work. Dan Lunt and colleagues at Bristol University showed that the simple sunshade approach does not take us back to a pre-industrial climate. In fact, it takes us to a completely different global climate, with the tropics being 1.5 degrees Celsius colder. The high latitudes would be 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer, and precipitation would drop by 5% globally compared with pre-industrial times. So perhaps we should just stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Summary. If we are to solve global warming, we need to tackle two fundamental principles. The first is to question the currently unsustainable lifestyle that we have in the developed world. If the 21st century human population of 6 to 9 billion obtains the same lifestyle as that of the USA, then not only will the requirement for food be greater than supply, but Earth's maximum eco-footprint will also be exceeded. It seems we need at least two planet Earths to support a global population with the same living standards as those in the West. So we need to reduce the energy and material requirements of society, and thus the aspirations of developing countries. It seems that having more stuff does not make us happier, but living longer and having a better quality of life does. The second principle concerns whether we, as a global society, are prepared to invest the relatively small amount, about 1-2% of world GDP, according to Stern, 2007, to offset a much larger bill in the future. If so, then we have the technology at the moment both to protect our population from climate change and to mitigate the huge predicted emissions of greenhouse gases over the next 100 years. As we have seen, energy efficiency, alternative energy sources, carbon trading, and offsetting all have a role to play. We must also consider disruptive technologies, that is, new technologies that we may not yet have even thought of that could change the way we produce or use energy. For example, most of us cannot think of life without a mobile phone or a computer, but this technology has been around for only a few decades. We can quickly become accustomed to change. There are also huge amounts of money to be made from opportunities surrounding changes to our energy use and our personal lifestyles. And as we will see in the next chapter, there may be many win-win situations whereby quality of life can be improved at the same time as we save the planet. Chapter 9. Visions of a Zero Carbon Future. In this chapter, I want to provide a vision of the future. Many people now throw around the terms zero carbon cities and zero carbon economy, but have no idea how to achieve them. What this chapter provides is a look at how our world will change to achieve these goals, because we must realize that our buildings, neighborhoods, transport networks, and cities will all have to change. I am indebted to Professor Yvonne Ryden, co-director of the UCL Environment Institute, who has provided the basis for these visions and has very kindly let me steal some of her ideas and expand on them. The following are some suggestions of what the low-carbon world of tomorrow might look like. Home of the Future. The three-story townhouse is part of a group of houses which collectively make up the Green Homes neighborhood in anywhere town in any country. They are grouped around a pleasant green space with some play and keep-fit equipment in the center. There is lots of greenery, some of it acting as sustainable urban drainage systems, and the rest as shade from the midday sun. There is a network of local pathways, which are well-lit and well-used. Close by are local shops, a primary school, and a community center. The community center notice board is testimony to the number of activities occurring there. Just outside the center is the express tramway stop, and behind is a small car park with some of the community electric car share vehicles and communal bicycles. The house displays its zero carbon energy certificate in the hallway, but the high levels of insulation in the building fabric are invisible to most visitors. Next to the certificate is the smart meter. This shows the remarkably low levels of electricity usage within the house, thanks to the energy efficiency measures and the solar water heating system on the roof. But the meter also shows when electricity is being generated by the household through the photovoltaic cells incorporated into the roof tiles, window shutters, and other flat surfaces. The house is built to deal with the extreme weather predicted for the region. High ceilings, solar shading, and efficient air conditioning powered by solar panels for the more frequent heat waves. Raised ground floor and flood channels in the surrounding area to deal with floods, especially urban flash floods. Deep foundations prevent damage to the house from soil shrinkage. The house is as water-efficient as it is energy-efficient. Outside, you can see the pipework for the rainwater harvesting system, collecting water into a special tank for feeding through into the house's plumbing system. Water separation is a feature of the house's plumbing. But the household hardly noticed this, or the water-saving features in the toilets, showers, and sinks. There is no garage or off-street parking for the house. Instead, there is a secure cycle store next to the composting unit. The rest of the household's waste goes into a vacuum waste removal system that also automatically sorts waste for collection and recycling at the community center. Office of the Future. Future offices are proud of their new headquarters. Approaching it from any of a number of nearby bus stops, tram stops, or the train station, visitors are often surprised by its attractive design, incorporating greenery at the ground floor, on numerous balconies, and right up to the green roof. The blades of the wind turbines catch the light, giving a clue to how some of the electricity demands of the occupiers are met. Less obvious is the system of district heating pipes that connect the office building with other local users, shops, restaurants, the cinema, local health center, and the college. The mix of users means that the heat demand is more or less balanced over the day and the week. All these users are connected into the area's combined heat and power unit. However, Future Offices, Inc. have found the energy demands of its new building are much lower than those of its older buildings. The building's fabric is highly energy efficient, but equally as important is the design that maximizes natural daylight while providing shade during the middle of the day, even when the sun is at its hottest. This and the natural internal ventilation system have removed the need for air conditioning, except during extreme heat waves, and have made for a much healthier internal environment. Future offices have made the health of workers a key aspect of the building. The stairs are visible features linking floors with cafes on mezzanine levels. The stairs are heavily used. The lifts don't stop at every floor, so it is often more convenient to use the stairs. In any case, the lifts are tucked away rather than being the focal point of the lobbies. Water efficiency measures have hugely reduced the water bill. This is despite a dedicated cycle and shower unit on the ground floor, with secure cycle storage and changing room facilities. Most of the office functions are not at ground floor level, however, and neither are the core services. The building is not far from the river, and flooding has become more common recently, so the ground floor is flood-proofed to ensure that the next flood will not disrupt business. Cities of the Future. Our cities have been transformed across the world. Mixed-use developments are situated around vibrant public spaces. These spaces create a strong sense of distinctive place for new developments. The old is integrated into the new with high-quality urban design. Pedestrians are given priority over the car in the planning of cities. There are dedicated routes for trams, guided buses, and cycles linking the different land uses. A mix of microgeneration technologies provide energy for building users. Combined heat and power and district heating schemes are routine for new mixed-use developments, some using renewable fuels. Many of these schemes draw the existing buildings into their scope as well. Greenery abounds, on the ground, but also on roofs, providing multifunctional spaces for amenity, leisure, natural habitats, and water drainage. Sustainable urban drainage systems are standard, transforming the look of urban areas. cities are as green and attractive as the countryside. Nearby rivers are managed for their landscape, leisure, and nature conservation value. They also form part of urban transport networks, with riverside cycle paths and walkways. Most importantly, the riverbanks and surrounding land absorb rainfall runoff and prevent flooding of built-up areas. Such cities encourage people to use their urban areas and to be active within them. Safe, pleasant, and green, cities all over the world contribute to the physical and mental health of their residents. Transport of the future. Local travel is now routinely accomplished by public transport, which includes underground and overground trains, buses, trams, and boats. The majority of private cars and taxis are electric. A significant proportion of goods is moved by rail, and then efficient electric vans and lorries. Separate cycle lanes and clear, well-lit pedestrian walkways are provided in all urban areas. Continental travel has been revolutionized as air traffic has been replaced with maglev, magnetically levitating trains traveling at 900 kilometers per hour, about 600 miles per hour, using renewable sources of electricity. These rail networks extend between major cities throughout the world, and fast connections allow people to travel across whole continents. The first coast-to-coast train versus plane race in the USA was won by the train, as the walk-on, walk-off train service removed the lengthy delays that occur at the airports. Intercontinental travel still uses traditional airplanes, but these super-sized commercial jets carry over 1,000 passengers each and are the most efficient ever made. Flights have become very expensive due to the global carbon tax on aviation fuel and thus are always operating at full capacity. They are towed to and from the runway, saving a significant amount of fuel and, of course, money. By the end of the 21st century, resources to fuel the new low-carbon global economy are running low. This is due to both the huge demand as the world rapidly develops and strict new global environmental protection laws. Space exploitation thus becomes cost-effective at the end of the 21st century. Carbon tax breaks on international space launches enable private companies and countries to set up orbiting space stations, and the mining of the moon begins. Economy of the future. Carbon Auditors Limited have just opened their new headquarters in London using all 143 floors of the first zero-carbon skyscraper. This attests to the huge market created in carbon trading since the momentous post-2012 international agreement. Renewable and alternative energy companies flourish, replacing the old oil giants as one of the main profit-generating industries in the world. They have been made so profitable by global carbon trading, which is driven by the gradually shrinking global cap on carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. Technological solutions to both emission reductions and adaptation to climate change have occurred at a fast rate through the 21st century, producing a global developed society unrecognizable from that of 100 years before. Everything from how plants grow to how we produce electricity has been improved. Contrary to the doom merchants, the global economy in the middle of the 21st century is growing at nearly 5% per year, twice the yearly average in the early 21st century. This is due to the increasing flow of money and expertise to the developing world through the post-2012 agreement and global carbon trading. The increased spending power of the developing world has stimulated the global economy, benefiting everyone with improved standards of living. The threat of global warming thus ultimately led to a more equal distribution of wealth across the world and a stronger, faster-growing global economy. Chapter 10. Conclusion. Global warming is one of the few scientific theories that makes us examine the whole basis of modern society. It is a theory that has politicians arguing, sets nations against each other, queries individual choices of lifestyle, and ultimately asks questions about humanity's relationship with the rest of the planet. There is very little doubt that global warming will change our climate in the next century. Our best estimates suggest an average temperature increase of 1.1 to 6.4 degrees Celsius, probably about 4 degrees Celsius, a sea level rise in the order of at least half a meter, as long as Greenland and Antarctica do not start to break down, significant changes in weather patterns, and more extreme climate events. This is not the end of the world, as envisaged by many environmentalists in the late 1980s and early 1990s, but it does mean a great deal of misery for billions of people. Global warming is the major challenge for our global society. We should not underestimate the challenge ahead of us. The climate predictions of the IPCC 2007 reports were based on carbon emission scenarios of the next 100 years that were realistic forecasts in 2000. We now know that the economic miracle in China will cause carbon emissions to rise between 11% and 13% between 2000 and 2010, instead of the highest estimate used for Asia by the IPCC of 2.6% to 4.8%. In addition, the consensus approach used by the IPCC to secure agreement from all parties means it is inherently conservative. We should perhaps, therefore, view the top estimates of climate change as the more likely to occur. So we are staring down the barrel of a gun, with over 6 degrees Celsius warming by 2100, and as discussed in Chapter 5, we really do not want to go there. The climate system is not linear, so there will be major tipping points when significant climate changes occur very rapidly. I have collated the tipping points which colleagues believe are most likely to happen in the near future and will be most devastating. If we cannot reverse the current global emissions trends, all of these tipping points will occur in our future. Add to this the estimates of top economists that it could cost us up to 20% of everything the world earns in the future to deal with a warmer world. In contrast, it may cost us only 1 to 2% of what we currently earn to convert our global economy to low carbon. Even if the cost benefits are not so great, the ethical case for paying now to prevent the deaths of tens of millions of people and the increase in human misery must be clear. So, what are the solutions to global warming? First, there must be an international political solution. Without a post-2012 agreement, we are looking at huge increases in global carbon emissions and devastating global warming. Any political agreement will have to include developing countries, and to protect their rapid development, as it is a moral imperative that people in the poorest countries have the right to develop and to obtain the same standards of living we in the West currently enjoy. As far as I can see, the only way to do this is to set up international carbon trading. This way, countries, industry, business, and individuals can reduce their carbon emissions and make money doing so. This is an excellent way for money to flow from richer countries to the poorer countries of the world. Of course, as the poorer countries develop, they will have more money to buy low-carbon technology from the richer countries, so continually stimulating the global economy. In addition, it will mean that there will be enough money for developing countries to adapt to the climate changes that will inevitably happen. Second, we must greatly increase the funding for developing cheap and clean energy production, as all economic development is based on increasing energy usage. This is starting to happen. Already, there is $1 billion U.S. dollar investment in clean technology by venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, and this is set to triple into the 2010s. This may sound like a lot of money, but in terms of research and development, it is very small. What we really need is a level of funding only ever achieved when a country is at war. The USA has spent over $1 trillion on the war in Iraq from 2003. Just imagine if all that money had been put into developing technology for a zero-carbon world. The International Energy Agency estimates that $20 trillion will be invested in energy over the next 25 years. What we must do is to ensure that it is not in fossil fuels. But even if renewable energy technology does become available, there is no guarantee that it would be made affordable to all nations, since we live in a world where even life-saving drugs are costed to achieve maximum profit. Nor is there any guarantee that if we had unlimited free energy, it would prevent us from continuing to abuse the planet. Paul Ehrlich at Stanford University, commenting on the possibility of unlimited clean energy from cold fusion, suggested it would be like giving a machine gun to an idiot child. We must not pin all our hopes on global politics and clean energy technology, so we must prepare for the worst and adapt. If implemented now, a lot of the costs and damage that could be caused by changing climate can be mitigated. This requires nations and regions to plan for the next 50 years, something that most societies are unable to do because of the very short-term nature of politics. So global warming challenges the very way we organize our society. Not only does it challenge the concept of the nation-state versus global responsibility, but the short-term vision of our political leaders. To answer the question of what we can do about global warming, we must change some of the basic rules of our society to allow us to adopt a much more global and long-term approach. I leave you with thoughts of redesigning our global community and with the slogan my wife dreamt up for the UCL Environment Institute, because we really do need cool solutions for a hotter world.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Global Warming, A Very Short Introduction by Mark Maslin, read by Kevin Parisot. Executive Producer, Maria Olson. Producer, Mike Charzik. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2009 by Mark Maslin. Production Copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.